ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why do humans hold on to stuff? Oddments we don't use and yet can't quite throw out. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? I'm Annabelle Crabb. Come and have a rummage through the story of us told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Forgiving the Mass Murderer. The extraordinary story from a shooting at a mosque. This is the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, and across the Pacific on Radio Australia. Later, the final in our series on religious communities rebuilding after violent attack. Now, after 2 weeks of hearings at the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, Australians have a picture of a Jewish community experiencing harassment and violence. The Commission also heard different opinions on anti-Semitism and political protest. Professor David Slukey heads the Australian Centre for Jewish Civilisation at Monash University. He's been following the hearings.
The more obvious things to us are the extreme acts of violence, a Bondi, a synagogue being firebombed. And those are very visible to many Australians. But I think what most people don't see and don't know are these kind of day-to-day experiences of intimidation, of being harassed out in public, school kids being spat at in public spaces, Jewish kids in non-Jewish schools being bullied mercilessly.
A school teacher reportedly doing a Hitler salute.
Yeah, these things coming to the surface are much more common and widespread than we think. You know, one of the things that was really affecting to me was the testimony from the CEO of Jewish Care Victoria, in which she talked about the experiences of her predominantly non-Jewish workforce being targeted because they work for a Jewish organization. And it just showed me that obviously anti-Semitism primarily affects Jews who experience it, but it affects us all in ways that are really damaging to the fabric of our multicultural democracy.
Mm. And Jewish Care, I mean, that's a social service agency. It's not a political agency. It's got nothing to do with foreign policy advocacy.
No, they do aged care homes. They provide disability services. They provide respite care. Mm. They're a historically important organisation in how the Australian Jewish community has arrived, integrated, and sustained itself over a long period of time. Mm.
There was the story of a 15-year-old boy. He's just playing Minecraft. Mm. And then there's a barrage of anti-Semitic comments, really violent stuff.
Yeah. Part of my brain that says, oh, teenage boys are being teenage boys with their lizard brains. But, you know, obviously, how much leeway do you give for people to target and bully and behave in that way? That was really interesting testimony to me, because I think we don't talk about the gaming sphere a lot. We talk a lot about social media. Mm. And actually, there's research internationally that talks about the prevalence of exactly that kind of story that that parent described and the boy described of his experience in the gaming sphere.
Rabbi Ben Elton, who's the rabbi of the historic Great Synagogue in Sydney, also said a couple of things that really registered with me. The first was that he said ghettos cannot be the answer for Jews in Australia. What was he saying there?
What we're talking about is not literal ghettos in the way that we talked about it in World War II era Europe or in medieval Italy. If I'm understanding him correctly, the answer isn't to build ever higher walls and fortify the community. So for people who haven't spent time in Sydney's eastern suburbs or in Melbourne's inner southeast, you might not have seen the ways in which Jewish community institutions, schools, synagogues are fortresses now, you know, ever higher fences, many more security cameras, bollards, armed guards in primary schools. It's quite confronting and quite shocking, the sense of fear that leads to that. some days I think, is it really necessary? And then a Bondi comes along and you think, my God, it's really a shocking thing to have to send your kids to a school like that. You know, just to go worship, to have to go through security protocols for that.
But Rabbi Ben Elton also said something, and I think this showed a fair bit of nuance. He said he would not consider a banner that said boycott or sanction Israel to be anti-Semitic if it were outside Parliament. You know, whether he agreed or disagreed, he would not consider that anti-Semitic. But he would consider it anti-Semitic when a banner was stretched over the front of his synagogue. What's the point that he's making here?
Context matters. That's really important, that protest is an integral part of our democratic society, and activism is an inherent part of the whole project of democracy. But if the target of your protest is, in this case, say, a synagogue, and maybe you disagree with things that they've said or not said, but if you're targeting them as the kind of avatars for Israel in this case, that's where you go beyond the pale. Sometimes the question might even be for us, if it's anti-Semitic or not, yes or no, that's important. But the more important thing is, what are you trying to accomplish by targeting the synagogue in this case? Are you trying to intimidate them? Are you trying to harass them? Are you trying to make them feel that they don't belong in this place? And I think if you call it anti-Semitism, if you don't, you know, that's the kind of conduct that we should be steering away from, I think.
Yeah, Julie Nathan from the Executive Council of Australian Jewry made a similar point. She said pro-Palestinian posters and Free Palestine stickers were not in and of themselves anti-Semitic, but again, if they were attached to a school or a synagogue. I read into this the argument, we are not, as individual Australian Jews, or even collectively as Australian Jews, gathered for worship or for education, we are not responsible for the decisions Benjamin Netanyahu was making in prosecuting his war in Gaza or Lebanon or Iran.
Yeah, I think holding Australian Jews responsible directly for that is where you start to get beyond the pale. The kind of assumptions that all Jews think the same way is part of the problem that underpins that. So you might target a synagogue, and there's a range of different views on the Israeli government and its conduct. There might be many different views on what Israel ought to be or ought not be. And to sort of paint a sort of broad brush where everyone is to the furthest extreme, you know, when it comes to Israel, that's again where you start to caricature people.
How successful, though, do you think the Royal Commission has been so far? And we're only a couple of weeks into these hearings, in trying to wrestle with the definition of anti-Semitism. Because there is other groups, the Jewish Council of Australia, pushing back against what they think is a far too consuming, far too broad definition of anti-Semitism. Do you think the Royal Commission has really getting to the nub of this?
The definitional question is a challenging one. We spend a lot of time talking about it. In ways, sometimes I think it takes us away from the core business. What we try and do with a definition, just in general, I'm a historian. Definitions is a way to contain an idea inside a box. But sometimes these ideas resist being contained in those ways. And so when we're trying to find something that has such deep historical roots as anti-Semitism, that has changed and morphed over a long period of time, that looks different in different places, we can start to come up against the limitations of our understanding. And so definitions are useful, and we should use them as a guide. And I think the way that the Royal Commission has deployed it is in a kind of sensible way, is to say, look, we're using this definition that is endorsed by the federal government.
And this is the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism.
The International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance.
And just in essence, it does suggest certain forms of criticism of Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state could be anti-Semitic.
Could be. So there's two parts to the IRA definition. There's the kind of top-line definition, which isn't the contested piece of it, and then there's examples of what may constitute anti-Semitism within that definition. And there's two or three in particular that are seen as controversial or maybe difficult to operationalize within the context of policies or governance. And they revolve specifically around criticism of Israel. So one example is applying a standard to Israel that you wouldn't apply to other like countries. That's kind of a tough one, like take a university environment to operationalize that, because if students are protesting Israel, what's the answer to that piece of it, that they must protest China equally or another country equally? It's a difficult one to like really prove, I guess, if you're trying to test it out in a legal setting, that that's going to, you know, fall on that side of the line.
And while you're here, though, I must ask you, I mean, the ABC and SBS have both declined to use that International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, arguing that it can inhibit journalistic inquiry. I mean, do you think that's a bad idea, an anti-Semitic idea in itself, in what the ABC and the SBS have decided to do?
I don't think it's anti-Semitic. If it's the right or wrong decision is, I think, a separate question to if it's anti-Semitic. And I don't think whether or not you adopt one definition or another is necessarily the thing that shows if you do or don't take anti-Semitism seriously. You know, I won't editorialize about whether I think it's a right or wrong decision, because I don't know enough about the mechanisms that have gone into it, except to say I don't see it in and of itself as anti-Semitic.
Not to use that definition.
That definition. If it's part of a bigger discussion of how do we tackle anti-Semitism, that's a kind of legitimate position, I would say, to take, to say there are many ways, you know, to tackle this problem. But if you're not having that conversation and just rejecting a definition, then I think it's probably bad policy, because what's the alternative? Whether it's an alternative definition or an alternative approach you're taking to defining it, I think there needs to be a sort of common understanding of what we're talking about when we talk about anti-Semitism. But also, context matters here.
Professor David Slukey of the Australian Centre for Jewish Civilization at Monash. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report on ABC Radio National. Former Governor-General and Anglican Archbishop of Brisbane, Peter Hollingworth, has died. In his early career, he was a champion of the poor, especially for his work running the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence. He challenged the Hawke government over welfare and child poverty. But the Royal Commission into Institutional Sexual Abuse and the Anglican Church itself made serious findings against him over his poor handling of child sexual abuse complaints. Dr. Hollingworth later said, "I have lived with my failures ever since." Peter Hollingworth was 91. Police in the US city of San Diego are treating as a hate crime an attack on a local mosque. The attack recalls an immense tragedy that took place 7 years ago, much closer to home. An Australian gunman slaughtered 51 Muslims at prayer at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. This is the third and final in our series, After the Storm, How Faith and Friendship Helped Three Religious Communities Overcome Violent Attack. You can find them as a podcast at ABC Listen. We recall the Christchurch tragedy with a man who survived, but bearing a terrible loss. Fareed Ahmed is the author of Huzna's Story, My Wife, the Christchurch Massacre, and My Journey to Forgiveness.
After the, you know, accident in Nelson, my physical life was changed totally. It's very difficult to explain that how every second in my life being on wheelchair is a struggle. But luckily, Husna had very positive attitude, and I also had positive attitude, so we have been managing. We were, you know, focusing on what we had rather than what we did not have. On that particular day, 15 March, two of us, we went to the mosque, same car. My car is all, you know, wheelchair, all hand-controlled, so I was driving. And as usually, we were chatting, we were two chatterboxes, but, you know, she was the champion. Yeah, she was champion. So we always talking. We never had run out of, talking. And the more talking we had, the more intimate and close we felt to our hearts about one another. I parked my car outside the mosque in the Hulshehr car park. The last words we had was that who should hold the key?
Right.
And I said, I will hold the key because today I'm not going to deliver any sermon. So two of us, we can quickly get out. We come to the car. We will go and pick up our daughter from high school. And then from there, we'll go somewhere to buy some special takeaway to enjoy at home. So that was our last conversation, but she pushed me to the men's side door, and then she went to the women's side door. So that was our last talk.
And you were in the mosque.
I was.
When the gunman burst in, you did manage to escape.
I did.
But Husna, she couldn't leave people behind.
Yeah, she was helping others. That was for one thing. But still, she managed to escape with some other people and children. And then she went to a nearby house. And then from there, in between the shooting, the shooter, he finished his bullets and then he was going to reload it. And she was sneaking in between. And she was keep coming to look for me, to rescue me. And third time, she was shot.
Yeah. She went back three times to find other people to help.
Yes.
Yeah.
So last two times, she went for me because, I was the only person in Hulshehr.
And yet, within days, you were saying that you could find it in your heart to forgive the gunman. That just, because he not only took your beloved wife, he took 50 prayerful Muslims at two mosques. How did you find this capacity to forgive this man?
I would say probably the first forgiveness to the person who drove over me has probably trained me to think about forgiveness. I remember when I was inside and he started the shooting, everyone, they ran away and I was alone. I was thinking that definitely today I'm going to be shot and today is my last day. But quickly, I turned my brain to a positive page and I said to myself, Fareed, you cannot complain. You are Mr. 7% and now you see how many years have you lived. My brain, my heart was racing. Every shot I heard, it was painful. It reminded me that this is going to be one more death. What will happen to me? What will happen to my wife? What will happen to the children, women, imam, and other worshippers? What will happen to the race relation in New Zealand? How the world, Muslim world, will react? Is there going to be any problems? So my brain was thinking, and with those thinking, one question came to my mind that how should I think about this shooter, about the shooter, anger, hatred, revenge, or what? And immediately the answer came to my mind. I said, no, I should feel that I am privileged to have a heart that has no anger or no hatred towards any human being. I should be thankful to God that, God, you have given me some common sense things. And if he had common sense like me, he would not have done what he was doing.
Yeah, your daughter, she's only 15 at the time. I was so affected to read what she said. she said, with this gunman, something must have gone terribly wrong in his own life.
Yes.
And you said we have to even try to find the capacity for generosity in the spirit of the mass murderer. What does your religion say to you to strengthen you with these sentiments?
It's religion gives us three options. One option is go for the justice. Second option is don't go for the justice, but settled compensation. And third option is just offer forgiveness. So I took the last one. I want to be loved by my God, you know, and I believe that God is very merciful. We begin the Quran with saying, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the kind, the merciful. Those who can control their anger and can forgive the fellow human, you know, it doesn't limit, it has to be a Muslim or non-Muslim, any fellow human, then the end of the verse says that God loves these forgivers. So I am, I'm a beggar. You know, I'm a beggar for God's forgiveness and God's love. So that was my biggest motivation. And plus the common sense. The common sense thing was that, you know, what will be best for my daughter, for me to go ahead, to move forward, and what my wife would want us to do. My wife was such a person, she would have said, push this grief aside rather than become swallowed by the grief, carry it successfully and do something better for this world. You know, my daughter and I decided at that night that we would walk on the path of peace. It was incredible freedom. Yeah. Incredible. Suddenly, you know, we felt like that, you know, we were not encaged anymore with anger, but we received the freedom to move forward and mentally and emotionally to do something better.
Yeah, 30 years ago, I heard an almost identical story from an incredibly courageous man called Bud Welch, whose daughter died in the Oklahoma City bombing. And he ended up befriending the family of Timothy McVeigh, the man whose bomb killed him and hundreds of other innocent people. Here on the Religion and Ethics Report on ABC Radio National, I'm speaking with Fareed Ahmed. He's the author of the book Husna's Story, My Wife, The Christchurch Massacre, and My Journey to Forgiveness. In the weeks and months to come, first of all, you would write this beautiful memoir, Husna's Story, that's the book, and you would meet some world leaders. But tell me about what I think was one of the most profound, and that was, well, with the man who's now the king, King Charles. You met him when he was the Prince of Wales. What did he say to you? Because he really touched you.
He did. At first, you know, I read that, you know, in his Easter speech, he mentioned my name. He said in his speech, Fareed is a remarkable example of forgiveness. That was very moving for me. I did not expect those things. To be honest with you, I have never thought that a word called forgiveness would be so moving for so many people. I did not have any least idea about it. I was shocked that what is happening. You know, when a BBC journalist told me, and after he interviewed me, he said, Mr. Ahmed, in half an hour, about 9 million views, and who knows after 24 hours, you know, how far it will go. I was shocked. But anyway, coming back to that time he was Prince Charles, I was very moved. And then I was going to a conference in Netherlands in The Hague, and then I received an email that he's inviting some of us to meet him in Christchurch. So I cut my time short there to come and meet him. And I found him so thoughtful, and I still remember he said something. He said to me, Fareed, I thought about forgiveness. You know, after your forgiveness, you know, I had the same question that how is it possible to forgive someone who has done the, you know, horrendous thing? But then when I looked into my heart, I found that the top layer is anger. And if that anger layer is removed, then underneath is kindness, forgiveness, compassion. I never heard such a beautiful introspection in my life beforehand. I will never forget it. He's very thoughtful.
Yeah, but I think the point is that the Prince of Wales, now the King, had been inspired by what you had done.
Oh, I'm very humbled by it.
One very, very difficult challenge, though. Could you ever come face to face with the mass murderer who did this?
I am ready. You know, I was ready, you know, soon after the tragedy. And, you know, I have been requesting the government in different ways that, you know, I would like to meet him. Maybe some people that think that, you know, just I'm talking emotionally. But no, look, I'm a healer. I am trained homeopath. I studied 7 years in homeopathy in New Zealand. My research topic was homeopathy and mind. And I also a Muslim counselor. I have been an independent voluntary marriage celebrant for 11 plus years. I have the heart. I have the mind to meet him, to talk to him. And I will not be angry. Even some people, they say, what if he's angry with you? I say, doesn't worry me. Some people ask me, what if, you know, you do not want to get what you want to get? My answer is, I don't have any expectation. So some people say, so why do you have to meet him? I say, this is my duty as human brother. Because our society, you know, there is a tendency that you do something wrong and you are thrown into the rubbish bin. My philosophy is that angel will never come down to teach one another. It is us, we human, who will have problem. We have to solve. We have to be patient. We have to be compassionate. And if we just, you know, throw one another out, what if I had a son and, you know, he did something terrible wrong? What would I do?
Yeah.
On one hand, I have to be compassionate to him, loving. On the other hand, I have to discipline him. So we need to have balance. But in our society, I see, you know, sometimes there is no balance. You know, someone has done something wrong and we put all our hatred towards that person without acknowledging that hatred is swallowing us also towards the hatred.
Yeah.
My point is, you know, if I consider myself as a good person, then I always have to maintain the high value.
Fareed Ahmed, author of Husna's Story, My Wife, The Christchurch Massacre, and My Journey to Forgiveness. You can find all three episodes of After the Storm in full at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you'll find all our stories. Before we go, it's a year since Leo became Pope. On Sunday evening, Soul Search speaks with Australian Augustinian priest Tony Banks. He's known Leo since 1981. He reveals how St. Augustine shapes this papacy. Thanks to producer Mandy Roberts and Isabella Tropiano. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.